They say we should have known better than to fall so deep down into this rabbit hole we found. And I was thinking,
hi, this is Nico. You're listening to My Dad Rafal, also known as the White Rabbit and James Jardine on the one and only Down the Security Rabbit Hole podcast. Buckle up and enjoy. Deep into this pool, incredible situations, pitch black, think back to the last time that we were happy.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. It is 3 o'clock on Friday, March 8th on the East Coast, and it is Daylight Savings Time weekend, I hear, which just means every clock in my house is going to be wrong for a while. Folks, we're doing this one streaming out live, so shout out to anybody listening that's live. I have assembled what I think is the better than the Avengers All-Star panel. But we've got a motley crew here. I think collectively we've got something like 1,000 years of collective experience or something here, something absurd.
I felt like a dig. Wow. That was a dig.
It's not a dig. Look, listen, this is the OG panel. How's that? Is that better?
All right.
I thought you were going to say better than average.
Right, really. Yeah. Better than average. I like it. All right. I'm going to do quick introductions, but first episode a little about this episode. We're going to talk about the catastrophic ransomware incidents going around and the pandemic of epidemics that's happening on the ransomware side. And we're not going to talk about what's going on with the Change Healthcare directly, because that's a whole set of things. We're going to use that as a backdrop sort of for the discussion. But first, I'm going to start to hold on, if I can do this correctly. That way. That's Jack. Jack, introduce yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, everyone. Jack Korzeniowski. I'm the head of cybersecurity and risk technology at William Blair. Been in cyber, almost 23, 24 years. Someone else said in IT, probably a little bit over 25. It's been a journey. Things are getting more complex. And as you know, what topics we're going to talk about today, it's the result of that complexity.
Next over, Mr. Jim.
Hey, everybody. Jim Tiller. Glad to be on again. And just a quick background on this particular case is, I think my biggest exposure to type of ransomware in dealing with these types of situations that we're talking about was when I was over at Kivu and COO at Kivu. That's all we did. Matter of fact, that company is clearly still around. They're still doing a great job in that space. So being exposed to a lot of pretty unfortunate situations. So I'd be very interested to see how this conversation goes.
All right. Under me, Mr. Sam Masiello. How are you, buddy?
I'm doing well. Thank you. How are
good.
You?
Good. Some background on you, bud?
Yeah. So I'm Sam Masiello. I'm the Enterprise CISO at the Anschutz Corporation. Been in security for about 25 years as well. Been a CISO for about the past 17, 18. Been around the block a few times, so looking forward to having a discussion today.
And Sam, if things get wild, you are our resident zebra, because you are you are a referee in real life as well. So
yes,
I fully expect you to.
I'll keep everyone in line. I'll do as good of a job keeping everyone in line here as I do in real life.
Oh boy!
Wait for the whistle to appear around his neck.
Right, there you go. All right, next to Sam, last but absolutely not least, Patrick. How are you, bud?
Good to see you, man. Patrick Dennis. I'm the CEO at Venafi right now. Long time listener, first time caller. Just kidding. I've been here a few times. Raph,
I was gonna say, wait a minute.
It's good to see you. I do, however, feel like we need rabbit hole like glow sticks for the EDM music intro next time around. If we're gonna do the OG one, I will sponsor the glow sticks.
That, you know what? I'm going to hold you. Let's do it. Glow sticks, baby. I'm in. Let's do that.
James, I told you.
Like glow sticks.
I'm waiting for him to have like the flashy right. lights in the background, everything. Yeah. Because, you know, I have to say, like, now that you've started doing that and we listen to it before each episode, it does get you kind of like your blood's pumping. Yeah. You're ready to go.
Right. If we're going to amp, we got to like do that, man.
The next episode Patrick is on, we'll have glow sticks. That's how
sweet.
It's gonna be.
Sweet.
We'll have to do it. We have to do a night episode.
We're gonna do. Yeah, I'm just gonna turn all the lights off. All you see is glow sticks waving around. Right. That's right. Patrick, maybe we ship you a disco ball.
All right, man. Right there.
Oh, fog machine. Oh, yeah. All right.
I'm really just hoping, too, you're going to get somebody to pop out of Jim's little tiny door back there with glow sticks, oh, yeah, too. Like that. That right. has to happen.
I got to work on that, man. We're going to do that for sure.
That's happening in post.
Yeah, I've seen too many ghost stories, so I'm just waiting for that door to start slowly opening up and a hand to start coming out of it.
Oh, man. Next time, man, I got you.
It'll be black with just two eyes. That's it. Like, the door's going to open, there's going to be eyes peering out.
Oh, boy. All right. Well, that's a good start. All right, guys. Level set. So we've had a series of really bad ransomware attacks over the last year or so, culminating in what is arguably the most impactful one right now, where a very large section of our healthcare system with regards to prescriptions and payers is completely frozen, stopped, to the point where there's letters being sent to, and I'm sorry, I don't mean to laugh at this, but just knowing the efficacy of Congress, to Congress, members of Congress to, you know, quote, do something. So it's a bad situation. And a rumor, you know, and like if you just watch the rumor mill, the gang that perpetrated all this, there was a $22 million Bitcoin payment made there. Now, all sorts of bad things happening. And where I want to start with is, this is the day that moment, right? All of us go through every day hoping that moment never happens, right? Back as a CEO, I can just only imagine that is one of those days where like you get a call, you're like, okay, this is the bad one. Like you're just hoping you do what you can, and you wait for that day never to come, but it does. And that, you know, the trade magazines are calling, lawyers are calling, everybody's calling you. I'm going to start with you, Patrick, because I want to get in your head a little bit. We'll go from there. What the heck goes through? So like, what, where does that start when you look at the ELT, executive leadership team of an organization that just got popped in a very bad way? How does, like, what does that day look like from an, obviously the day is kind of blown up for you, but what does that look like from the ELT perspective?
I guess maybe the first part is just like, you know, Raph, you and I have known each other a long time and I've been doing these CEO gigs a long time and let's hope I get to hang it up sooner or later. It's changed a lot. You know, it used to be that, you know, when we first started to talk about these issues, security incidents were kind of like down and to the left and, you know, it was a bad day. And you cared and your company cared and you worried about your customers. But you weren't worried about the SEC. You probably weren't worried about whether a nation state had targeted you.
Yeah.
You probably thought your best people would get you out of it in a reasonable period of time. I think that's like all changed. And so, you know, I worry a lot about a lot of us put our best people in CISO positions and, you know, they were our like front line of defense as a CEO. I worry a lot that now what's happening is putting them in rooms with lawyers and putting them in tough spots with their own personal liability. And it's kind of moved them back from why we put them in those spots in the first place, which was, you know, they're the people that are best prepared to defend us. And so I think what has changed and what really kind of like keeps me up at night about this issue, it broadly, not just ransomware, is, you know, like you brought the healthcare thing up, right? Like that's a national security level thing. Like people are going to be impacted by that. Like lots and lots and lots and lots of people. Like, mm-hmm. We don't need the SEC trying to figure out how they want to adjudicate that issue or some other lawyer coming in around the edges. Like the first thing we need to do is like get people medicine. And maybe that's a good example only because like as a CEO, your first thought is like, how do I get my customers back to a good place? Cause you're probably doing something that matters, you know, maybe with a sprinkle of on top, if you're in my line of work and you're, you know, your company runs a security business, you take this stuff like ultra seriously. But I think that's moved. I think everybody's taking it ultra seriously now. So yeah. I think my first observation is just like the landscape has changed a lot. It's gotten way more difficult. We put our best people on it. I don't want my best people spending time with the lawyers. I want them getting our customers back to a good spot. And I'm just not sure we've created an environment where that's the priority.
So whoever wants to take this, how do we effectively separate that? Because this is a situation where we'll liken it to something, because I do analogies. You know, the building is on fire. You've got people inside, people outside. Some you don't know where they are. You've got a fire truck coming. You've got mobile incident command, right? So you've got outside help coming. You've got the news calling you saying, hey, I hear your building's on fire. Like, you have to manage, somebody has to manage a lot of things. Is that centrally managed or is that decentralized today? Does anybody want to take that one?
I think what I've seen is, you know, the war room tactic.
Yeah.
Bring everybody together. Somebody's pretty much acting like the coach. I've seen scenarios where that's, in some cases, the CISO. A lot of that should be defined in your incident response plan. Let's just kind of get the should do's out of the way for a second and have an incident response plan and, you know, test it and all that kind of good jazz, tabletops. But usually what you do, you find, I don't know if you guys agree, but it'll be somebody that kind of takes lead, kind of points, and then kind of goes into kind of distributed leadership. Okay, you take, you know, dealing with key customers, like the top echelon. You take dealing with these customers. You take dealing with the media. You take making sure our employees are okay. You take dealing with our core competencies around IT, and then you're going to address third parties. So you start building these sort of cones of focus, and then you set up this sort of round robin, constant reporting back. And so it's sort of, I would say, centralized distributed model, I guess would be a weird way of saying it. But I see the other guys nodding their heads a little bit.
Yeah, I can add to that. So, you know, we call it incident command. We do have a person actually in that seat. That's the role. And they're the ones that the intake all the information, right? And initial impact assessment and who's doing kind of a what. But also being the center of all channels that are going back and forth. So your legal, right? So your business, your clients, your lawyers, your technical people. He's the one that kind of is the holding the war room, so to speak, right? The bridge open and make sure that things are flowing through. And to your point, Patrick, earlier, right? You want the experts to focus on the recovery, right? On the aspects, containment, recovery, everything else, right? You don't want them to be answering to the CEO and chief legal counsel and CIO and everybody else, right? You want them to be boots on the ground and then fixing and restoring as quickly as efficiently as possible. So I agree with that. And that's kind of how we structure a little bit our program here. So we have a technical aspect, we have a managerial aspect, and the IC is actually the one kind of being the hub, if you will.
Hey, Rev.
So I want to jump in on that. So Jim kind of glossed over the entire incident response plan development process and the testing and the tabletops, right? But I don't think we should gloss over that, because that's an important aspect of the development of your incident response program that I feel like a lot of people don't do well or don't do at all. And so, you know, while Jim has kind of, you know, made it assume those things were in place, I don't want to assume that they are, because I think in a lot of cases, people run into an incident and they don't have that plan in place. They haven't had those internal discussions. They haven't had that internal coordination. And so what ends up happening is you have people running around like chickens with their heads cut off, all trying to do 20 different things in 20 different directions at 20 different times, all well-intentioned and well-meaning. However, it's not being done in a coordinated way. And so I've seen instances before where people have decided, well, we're having this incident, so I'm going to go contact this regulator because, you know, the law says we're supposed to contact the regulator before we've had any discussions internally about what you're going to tell the regulator and what actually happened. And so then you start getting phone calls from regulators asking what's going on and what happened before you even figured out what's gone on and what's happened. So I don't want to gloss over the preparation aspect that goes into this, because having had those discussions and having had those preparatory conversations around who the incident commander is or who's running point, how do they run point, how do people get pulled into the conversation, when do they get pulled into the conversation, is an important aspect of making sure you maintain a well-coordinated response.
That's 100%.
I'm going to add 2 cents to that really quick, Sam. So one is I did skip over it for a couple of reasons. One is it's such a huge topic. And the fact of the matter is if you don't have that incident response plan, that's table stakes. So, you know, the rest of this conversation is not going to mean anything to you because you're not going to be prepared. And you're going to get steamrolled. So, you know, change the channel. But sorry, don't change the channel. Sorry about that, Raph. Stay on. Listen.
And we're done.
Okay, it's over.
Take more notes.
Yeah, exactly. So, but the fact of the matter is you're absolutely right. But I would actually add another component to it is we spend a lot of time saying, like you said, get it done and test it. And here on this OG panel, we know what that means. And I can't tell you how many times where people go, okay, here's our incident response plan. We'll do a test. Everything's nice and hunky-dory. And then when it happens, everybody's running around with their hair on fire. You know, and I think is you absolutely need to put all your energy into that. It's definitely one of those situations where it's not like you have to plan to plan and then, you know, it doesn't survive first contact with the enemy. When it comes to incident response plans, it is the thing that you go to. So I'm 100% with you, Sam. I think the challenge is that very, very few people are actually putting plans in place that take nuance. And if I may, and then I'll shut up, Patrick brings up a really good point about the dynamics, all this has changed. And you brought it up as well. It's like, okay, now we have the SEC to report to. When does that phone call need to be made? What are the implications of making that? Are we prepared? You know, so that dynamic that Patrick brought up earlier plays into it well. So I would say the IR plan and testing is probably the biggest thing you can do right now to set yourself up for success. But that in of itself is a massive conversation.
Like how in-depth testing occurs, right? Because, you know, ransomware hits your system and the whole thing goes down. I'd be curious to see a company that shut their whole system down and saw how they reacted to, you know what I mean? Like if you're actually testing it, you're testing a small, very tiny portion of, oh, we shut that server down. We brought it back up. It wasn't a, oh my gosh, we just lost 50,000 servers. How do we go about, right? Like the scale of the testing doesn't match, I don't think, in most times, the reality of what happens, right? And that, right, it's that whole, you know, you have a plan until you get punched in the face, right? Like the plan's out the window.
Only a matter of time until Mike Tyson came up. Good job.
I know two things on the OG episode for my friends, Jim and Sam. The incident response plan for my company is 8 feet that way in a red binder and it's printed. And
excellent.
Yep. Like, listen, man, the first line is when this stuff goes south, you got to assume all this stuff isn't going to work. Right. So, you know, do a test. Should be like, you know, you should be able to point. It doesn't have to be 8 feet. Right. And then, you know, like maybe one little reminder. I didn't know when it would come up today, but like did anybody else's cell phone go out? You know, I'm an AT&T guy.
100%.
Yeah. So I think like there was a reminder in there for us, you know, get the binder printed so that if you can't get to it for whatever reason electronically, you got it. And you got to think through some basic comm stuff. Right. And I know that's hard to believe when you're like on Zoom 24 hours a day, but you know, stuff happens, right?
You know, well, does anybody else get, anybody really happy to hear the CEO of a great company saying that he's got his IR plan like 8 feet away? I can't think of any other CEOs.
That's fantastic.
Kudos to you, man. I'm very happy.
It's replay value, Jim. It's back there. Yeah,
100%. That's awesome.
I was hoping, Jim, he was going to come pull it out the inside of his vest there for a second and be like, right here.
Listen, you guys, I just anecdotally, Patrick, to just put a very fine point on that. Way, way back, and I was with GE and part of the security team, when SQL Slammer hit, everything we had was online, on the network, at which point nothing on the network was accessible. So you're like, oh, I'm going to go ahead and call the person. Oh, no, wait. I can't pull up their phone number in the gal. Right. It's offline.
Right. I know it's silly, but I think, you know, one of the things, I guess, if there's anybody listening that, you know, has these good folks supporting them, like they support me in my gig, like print that thing, take it seriously, make sure the phone numbers are updated. You know, last thing a person like Sam needs, I'll pick on Sam in his life, is you being kind of a dum-dum about your comms infrastructure when he's in the middle of an incident. Yeah, that stinks, you know? So that's my PSA, Raph. You don't have to pay any extra for that. I couldn't do the like doot 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 doot. the right way, but Wolf PSA.
I like it. Listen, so we touched on this kind of so now that we've got that piece covered, print your stuff. Let's touch on the regulatory, because Sam, you brought it up, right? You called the regulator. Like, there are reporting requirements, okay? So like half of your systems, 10% of your systems, something is down, inaccessible, dead, corrupt, stolen, whatever. There are no shortage of reporting requirements, depending on the state you're in, the industry you're in, whether, God help you, you're in New York, right? Because some places they give you, you know, 7 days, some places like expect you to know everything in 5 minutes. How do you make meaningful sense out of the potentially dozens, if not, you know, more reporting regulations and requirements that you have at a level that I'm not entirely sure all the CISOs I know really understand the implication. Like, you know what you got to, why you got to do it, because it says so, but there are implications there. Patrick, I think you might be able to speak to that too. Like, there's implications behind like, oh, I have to report this to the SEC. Like, wait a minute. There's stuff that happens when I do that. Right. So
yeah,
talk to me about how you survive that in a sane way without just throwing like guesswork at people, because you don't know right away.
So like many things in our lives, you know, you have to figure out how much risk tolerance you have, right? And if you're a 50 person company and you're not publicly traded, that tolerance looks a lot different than if you're Jack. Like, Jack's actually probably in the toughest spot on this particular Zoom, right? Where there's a lot of regulation in a lot of ways, right? And so I guess like the macro advice would be this. It tends to be, you all think about like tabletop drills. Like, you can run one of those at the board level. And, you know, on the boards that I'm on, I make us do that, which is, hey, if the team is working down here on the stuff, all right, and it's rolling up to the board, which it may, in Jack's case, it's gonna for sure, right?
You know too much.
Maybe a pinch. you know, you need a phone list. It's a different phone list, by the way. It's got, you know, Kirkland and Ellis on it, and it's got, you know, a bunch of other lawyers, right? And it's got Latham Watkins, and by the way, it's not going to be cheap, but. You know, the important thing to remember in those situations is kind of there's two dimensions typically. There's timing. When do you have to do things? And then there's levels, like what has to be disclosed. And I think if I were just to draw like one important distinction for this audience would be the change in my mind in the last, call it year. Typically, if you made a disclosure on an issue back here, nobody was going to go and evaluate that disclosure at some point in the future, right? Very often these days, the SEC is actually turning around and evaluating whether or not disclosures you made in the past were sufficient. And so I think that is changing how people think of disclosing issues today, because then that was not the practice. That is more often the practice. And so, you know, you need a couple of things. You need great people like that are here on Zoom giving you good information about the facts around the actual issue. And then, quite honestly, the other part of your incident response plan is what's the legal team that's going to help you evaluate how to message those things and when. And it's not perfect. And I'd love to hear Jack's take on this. Like I said, I think, Jack, you're in an industry where it's super complicated.
Yeah, I can expand on that. So, you know, I always say, keep your friends close, your lawyers close. and that's for a good reason, right? Because what you just said, really, I'm the one that can give them enough context with the business overlay for them to make a decision as to what and how to disclose, because they're the ones actually going to have to do that. We do have also a compliance department that handles a lot of the SEC, FINRA stuff, right? So those are the people that quite frequently I'm in conversations with, almost daily, and then obviously the study meetings and all of the above, with the intent of, I'm here, and here's what I'm educating you on, here's why, but there will be time where you will have to actually kind of represent or help me to navigate my my situation. It's a two-way relationship, any way you slice it. I learned a lot about law, whether I learned or not. I learned how to, you know, articulate certain things to certain people, because that's really how you get the point across in a time of need. That relationship is going to be instrumental, right, in addressing the issue, especially regulators. And that's really, you know, the AI. I don't want to even go to AI, but that's SEC already doing, you know, very broad sweeps as to what's happening in this, in the financial sector. And they're looking very closely already. So I'll leave all digress.
And hey, Ralph,
I think the basic foundational tenet of what we talked about so far has been around preparation, right? Of being prepared for when the actual event occurs, because it's not really a question. People say it all the time, right? It's not a question of if, it's a question of when. And we've talked about the preparation aspect of having the plan and testing the plan, the conversations to have with the lawyers. The other conversation you need to have internally, especially as it relates to the SEC regulations, is around materiality. What defines materiality within your organization, because that's going to largely drive, at least within the SEC rules, whether or not you have to disclose. And that is another thing that is very subjective per organization. In fact, we've seen even some instances now where some large companies have had incidents and they are deciding whether or not they need to disclose because they're like, well, maybe this isn't material enough. Maybe it doesn't really fall under our definition of materiality, right? So it should help start driving some of those conversations within the business as well as to what materiality means to the business, so you can decide whether or not this is something that falls within that definition and needs to be disclosed. While today the SEC guidelines are only within the purview of public companies, I guarantee you these same sorts of regulations are going to come down to privately held companies as well.
Who defines that material? Like whether it's material though, like is it internally the organization can define that, or
internally. Yeah.
Can yeah. somebody yeah, externally say, "Wow, that looks material to me," even though you said it's not? No, it's just internal. No,
okay. Internally, those are all internal discussions that have to be had, which is why that's a big part of that preparation process, and why I think it's going to be, quite frankly, a very subjective conversation that occurs. Because, like I said, there was a couple of big companies that have already had incidents who are like, "Well, you know, maybe this isn't material," because quite frankly, they don't want to disclose mm-hmm. all the information that you have to disclose in the 8K to make that a reasonable disclosure.
And so far it's not working. So one, they decide was material. The intent was material relative to investor decision making.
Right.
Right. That was the actual driving factor, right? Am I going to invest in a company and find out it got tipped over and lose a ton? And then the other piece of it was the 8K was supposed to, and you look at the SEC regulation, the 8K is supposed to outline quantitatively or qualitatively, what are those sort of material influences and how that relates to the stability of the organization? Nobody's even done that yet, right? It's like, oh, we have a material thing, and there's a paragraph saying somebody tipped over the water cooler and we're mopping it up, kind of thing. Not like, you know, the building's burning down. So I think there's actually a big breakdown. But two things have happened. One is you've gone on record. So now everybody's like, and for some companies, there's a little bit of dip in stock, maybe a little bit of news. Yeah. Some they just slide right across the window and nobody cares. And then now we get into the whole fining aspect of reporting and noncompliance. And I don't know if this is the right form to bring it up in, but then we get into this whole situation is there's no upside for the company here. They're already under attack. Now the SEC is going to investigate. And then it's just all of a sudden, all a bunch of people in suits show up. Now that on top of getting bumped off basically creates a horrible scenario. We're in a very desperate time when it comes to having to be forced to notify the world in many cases, and the introduction of additional law enforcement that is not there to help. I mean, maybe in some cases they are. I'm not downing FBI and things like that in any way, shape, or form. But then you have this, really, it's they're coming in to see how much they're going to fine you. And not only that, but it's the same thing if you have cyber insurance. They come in and, you know, do the forensics investigation. Part of that is, were you doing what you said you did when you got your premium? And if you didn't, guess what? They're not going to help you pay if that's the decision you decide you want to take, right? So it's a very, very tenuous situation with regards to regulations, fines, exposures. So there could be a point, and you even said it a minute ago, Sam, dead spot on. It's not just public companies, it's private spaces. We're seeing that even with sort of the laws that are passing back in 2022, 2021 concerning infrastructure, all that stuff, right? So it's coming fast. So you think it's bad getting just ransomed and your hair is on fire. Now everybody's showing up your front door going, okay, I need more money, more time. And you're trying to get your business back up and running, and you're dealing with this very critical decision of paying to be able to decrypt your data to get back to your investors and your clients. Some of those are in a hospital bed. And then meanwhile, now you're facing more fines. It's a desperate situation.
And you have the government saying, you know, we don't want you paying the ransom, right? Like pieces that are pushing out saying, we want to make that illegal. You can't pay.
Let's go there because this is – I see Patrick's about to explode if we don't get there.
I think he changed colors.
Because here's the part that's crazy to me, right? And just like work with me on this one. This will be a part where my world comes out a little bit. Like, how much did you say this healthcare company paid?
$22 million, allegedly. Allegedly.
Allegedly, yeah, $22 million.
Okay, that's like the bill from the lawyers on a $5 billion company that has an incident. That isn't even the SEC payment. So like, I'm just playing the other side of this, right? Like, and it's like, I'm in the get real mode here. Like, so if you're the person sitting in that chair and they're like, dude, they're asking you for $22 million. And you're like, hey, lawyer, what's it going to cost us to get out of this? And they're like, well, I'm going to be $22 million. And then you're going to owe the shareholders $500 million. You're like, 22 might not be so bad. So I think, you know, listen, there's a weird incentive system right now. You know, Raph, you started off with the ransomware thing. It's a great example. You know, some of these decisions are super hard because, like, on one hand, I'm sure everybody here would be grateful if somebody just magically wired them $22 million, right? On the other hand, it pales. Sure, send it to Raph. he's gonna put the wiring instructions on this podcast. But like the other side is, you know, SEC fines are no joke, right? And you know, you get into personal liability, a bunch of other stuff. Net, I just tell you, like, I understand the pressure less sophisticated executive teams would feel in a situation like this because it's actually pretty short money.
And that's unpopular what we see.
Opinion, but true, right?
Right. I mean, you see that. I mean, it's all relative to the organization. I mean, didn't one of the Vegas hotels pay? And like, if you compare the amount that they paid to the amount that they bring in per day, like, I mean, it was barely 1% probably of the CEO's bonus. Like, it was like, whatever, like, I'll pay this. Like that.
Okay. So this takes me to a place I don't like going mentally, which is like, I get it. This is all a numbers game. A friend of mine, when I was working in a consumer financial division of MG, once asked me, cause I was sitting in a room trying to tell him why we should secure all the things and spend a lot of money. He asked me how much, credit card fraud there was in the entire system. I was like, hold on. I can go look. He goes, you don't have to look at it. He goes, the answer is as much as the system will tolerate. Hmm. And I've carried that with me. So now, you know, it's like, why was that ransom payment $22 million, $40 million, $5 million, $100,000, whatever? It's because that's what it's like. I have a feeling, and God help us, that these ransomware gangs have somebody that actually knows the rules and regulations, right? That knows exactly where the point is that you're going to be like, you know what? That's too much. I'm going to fight this versus what Patrick just did, which was like, like, let's write the check.
Mm-hmm. Well, in some cases, they're stealing all the data to learn all that.
That's smart.
Right.
That's true.
Yeah, it's a different.
That's true. Yep. Facts.
Well, and I think, you know, you also have the situation, you know, depending on what's being taken down. Like, you take Colonial Pipelines, you take the healthcare situations, right? Like, if you're not able to recover within X amount of time, like, at what point, like, yeah, we got to pay the ransom.
Right.
Like, that's our only way to get back up. This isn't some different type of shop. Like, oh, Facebook went down, whatever. Like, okay, nobody has access for a while. Like, you're talking about serious things that are being held up from a critical infrastructure standpoint. Like, at some point, there has to be a line drawn that says, okay, we're not going to be able to recover this for another 2 months. We need, like, we have to do this.
And these guys know that, right? They know the cost to recover versus the cost of getting paid. I mean, they ultimately, from their perspective, they want to get paid. And granted, even if they get paid, there's no guarantee you get your data back and you get your systems back online. So there's still a risk you're taking by paying the ransom. But they certainly know, right? It's enough to cause pain. It's enough that they make a good amount of money, but it's still enough where the cost to recover on your own is going to be more expensive than the cost to just pay.
To James's point, when what was it, MGM? There was actually two that got ransom, one paid, and one decided to fight against us. And I think the numbers were like this. I mean, I think one paid $100 million to recover, and I can't remember the exact details.
I think you're right. Yeah, one of them paid the ransom, one of them paid a ton to actually recover and didn't pay the ransom.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think in both situations, right, I mean, it's a minor percentage of their revenue,
But it definitely
either case, it wasn't
Patrick's
that big of a
point.
Deal, right? Yeah, for a lot of companies, that would have been a huge deal. For them, it was like,
Saturday night.
Here's that slot machine over in the corner. Take it.
But I think to add to that, you know, if you pull back a little bit here, there's always these what if scenarios being analyzed, right? So we have an idea what happened, right, and approximately how much the eligible payment was, but. You know, being at the table and making the decision, what do we pay? What do we don't pay? What's going to happen? And then that puts a little bit different perspective when you're in the heat of the fire and you have to think all possible outcomes. And then you kind of have to live with it. So I understand it's a tough situation, tough spot to be in, right? And you have to live with it because it may come to fruition that it didn't work, right? I think, Sam, you said that you may get your data, you may not. And you may have to start anew. I think we've had those situations as well, right? So it's a tough situation to be in. And I think the bigger question is, it's been quite a few years of ransomware, and there's no end in sight.
Yeah. Hey, Jack.
I just don't think we're gonna be retired. According to Raf, you know, we're gonna be 2,000 years old, and ransomware still gonna exist.
Hey, Jack. Who or anybody else? Who makes that decision? Who makes the call? I'm kind of curious because I'm asking because I don't really know. Who makes the call that says, yep, we're going to write that check?
Well, that's what I actually wanted to talk about next was I keep preaching about preparation, right? This is another one of those discussions you need to be having in advance to decide what that boundary line is. And also make sure that you are set up to be able to pay if you are going to pay. Because the last time you want to try to figure out what a Bitcoin wallet is or how to set up a Bitcoin wallet or how to pay how to make a Bitcoin transaction.
That's right.
Is while you're in the middle of all of this and the clock is ticking on whether or not you're going to be able to get your data back.
Yeah.
So again, more preparation is what's the saying? An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, right? And I know I've said the word preparation like 10 times, but this is again part of those conversations you need to be having, not only internally with your business folks, but with your business leaders, but also think about the other risk transference mechanisms that you may have that could help you here, like cyber insurance, for example. Do you have cyber insurance? What conversations are you having with your cyber insurance carrier? Can they potentially bring in a negotiator if you want to potentially pay the ransom and maybe they can bring that ransom number down for you? Because again, eventually the goal of the cyber criminal is to get paid. And so whether they made $22 million or $15 million doesn't really guess matter to them too much. But at the end of the day, if the company that paid could have saved $7 million off that transaction because they had a negotiator in helping them from their cyber insurance carrier, that could be a benefit to them. Also, the cyber insurance company can also be looking at things like, can you even pay these people? Like, are these people in an OFAC sanctioned country where you potentially could get yourself in legal trouble if you pay the ransom?
That's a real one. Yeah, that's a real one.
That's legit. That's a real thing.
Super legit. Yeah. Going through the actual payment process itself is very, very tricky. And you have to be able to make sure you're okay. Otherwise, you start falling into all kinds of legal activities, international, all kinds of interesting things, right? All of a sudden, you're the target of law enforcement because you're essentially, you could be funding terrorists or something, which we're not going to get into where the money goes once it goes into, we can really get into a whole conversation what it probably is actually funding and stuff like that. But that's an excellent point, Sam.
To give you an idea how practical that is. So this morning I woke up, I took 5 printed copies of my passport to the notary with my passport to notarize my passports to get sent over to a foreign entity. Details don't matter. Just to make sure that it's stood up and we have bank accounts and all that sort of stuff. Right. And so these practical things that Sam brings up are totally true. Like, could we issue a Bitcoin payment right now? Like in the 5 companies I'm the closest to, I don't think we could. And by the way, I'm the director in a few of our entities, and in some of those entities, I have like personal liability. So Sam's point's super accurate. And by the way, it adds another whole level of complexity to this whole thing, which is probably the people that are making the decision, Raph. And I'm not going to answer like who that is specifically, but some of them may actually have more on the stake as human beings with families that live in houses like the rest of us than many people even understand for all the reasons both Sam and Jim just brought up. That's a real thing.
So there's a question that somebody posed to us in the YouTube live stream that says, should there be a threshold that triggers the, hey, let's pay? I think we've kind of talked about it a little bit, but is there a, like, is there a magic formula for this, you guys?
But just pay, like you have it and just, you hit the pay.
Like, button? Hey, this is small enough. Let's just go. Let's not think about it. Let's just pay it. Like, is there like an algorithm that's, you know, that says, okay, how prepared are we? What's our confidence in our preparedness? What's, you know, how much of this of our whatever, like, is that a thing, or is it every one of these critically analyzed in a room with lots of alcohol? I mean, coffee.
I would argue that most of it is, hey, let's pay. It's press the button, go. I maybe less so recently, but when we talk about these big ones, like $22 million, all this kind of stuff that has allegedly been paid, I do think that kind of pulls back and let's make a decision. But I think there's a lot of small and medium sized companies out there that get hit. And it's like, you mean I just have to pay 50 grand and I can get my stuff back and I'm back up and going? And I got a consultant wanting 150 grand to get me, you know, my backups restored? Pay. That is, believe it or not, there are.
I believe it.
I've personally been involved in $1 million of various transactions that are less than, you know, six figures.
I think that's a really good point. I think that segmentation point's a really good point. My understanding is it's not what I do for a living, but the companies that are, you know, mid-sized down pay more often than not and just move on with life.
They don't have the assets. Which is
sad. Yeah. Yeah, it's sad, right? But yeah. I think that's probably true.
That's why a lot of this stuff is sort of outsourced, right? A lot of the stuff is drive-by. Oh, somebody clicked a link and it pops up on a radar and goes, oh, I got a ransom coming in. Let me negotiate that, right?
Let me ask this differently, because we've been talking about this from a clear perspective of cyber. Is this any different, and if so, how, than like other types of extortion? Because there's insurance for that, right? Don't we buy is it called K&O? Like for kidnappings and other types of things. Is this just similar to that, but like with ones and zeros?
I believe I'm talking a lot here, barking over everybody, but I believe absolutely is crime, but now we live in a digital space that has broadened that ability for anybody to enter into that crime family and to do it halfway around the world. I think these is, especially with the introduction of cryptocurrency, it's now ultimately made it available to anybody. It's, if you want to commit a crime, it's super easy now.
I remember I gave a talk called 100% of crime will be digital 1 year, Raph, when you came to my show, and everybody got wicked pissed at me for that. Like, it was super controversial. I stand on that point. Maybe the ultimate outcome is not digital, but I think 100% of crime these days, you know, in some way, shape, or form is digital. And I think you're asking the right question. It's like, how closely do the historic patterns match to the digital version of that? You know, this one's tricky because, you know, I'd argue extortion was actually pretty hard because you actually had to get close to somebody to do it. You know, if computing costs come down, which they have, and performance goes up, which it has, and so now you're more performant at lower cost, you can just do more of this.
Oh, that's the thing.
That double-edged sword.
Right? Like, yeah, I mean, the ease of it, like there's no, what's my escape route? I don't need a getaway driver, right? You're not locked into the bottom of Nakatomi Plaza for the entire evening trying to figure out, once the FBI swarms you, how do I get out of this jam? You're sitting someplace across 18 different VPNs that you're anonymous as anything. And you take all the time in the world to be able to push through that. Like, why would I try to walk into a bank and try to rob that vault
when you can do it with a Mai Tai in your hand from the beach?
Right. Yeah.
Your exposure is next to zero. your cost is minimal compared to what you can make, and you can automate half of it.
That's right. We should probably not be making a case that this is a good business model. Although
I'm curious,
we all did this. Oh boy! Oh boy! Oh boy.
I'm curious,
but that's the unfortunate part, right? The cost of entry is so low now, and the amount of knowledge that's required is so low. In fact, you go out and buy these phishing kits. They'll provide you support on their software, you know, to launch a phishing attack or to launch a ransomware campaign, right? So they've made it easier than ever for people who want to get into being a criminal to being a criminal, and that's unfortunate for the rest of us because we're the ones that are on the receiving end.
Well, and in the one you brought up, wasn't there an as a service involved in that? Like, didn't they actually have a
Yes.
I mean, come on.
It's a multi-tier system, but effectively. The pointy end of the spear that took the money was like, hey, affiliates that, you know, I owe money to later. And they they shut everything down and peaced out. And there was an article, I think it was it Forbes or one of the others that was like, well, they're ruining their reputation. And I'm thinking to myself, they have 22 million. What?
You know, they're running like business, right? Risk benefit. You know, the amount of effort, investment, and what's the payout, and move on. And it's really not that complicated, like we just all talk about.
You know, they're having. You know, the reality of it is this is why they're adopting the bad guys, if you will, are adopting all these crazy technologies so quickly because there's nothing holding them back, and they're flush with cash, right? And they're able to move quickly because it's literally shooting fish in a barrel. Right? It's literally shooting fish in a barrel.
Are we seeing that difference, though? Like, I mean, Raph, what, a year ago, maybe even almost 2 years ago, we had the episode where we talked about ransomware was dead. You've got to see this. Like, here's this technology grabbing the encryption keys, and we can decrypt it, and good luck. Like, is that taking off? Like, are we seeing better protections of that type of stuff where we're seeing – you know, some of these solutions getting rolled out in the enterprise that can capture it. And what, you know, our whole topic then was, well, we're going to change from encrypting to just stealing the data, which we are seeing a lot more of the stealing the data, but the stealing the data does not take your systems down, right? Prescriptions still get filled. You still get gas through the pipeline if you just steal our data versus encrypting stuff. I mean, have we seen technology come far enough where we can actually be better at stopping the encryption part?
James is on the be better kick. Come on, people, be better.
I'm just curious. The claim was there, right? Like, wow, like we've got this great technology to do this. And I know there's more than one company doing it, but is it effective? You know, and they have articles once in a while, press releases. Oh, we saved this person from the, or, you know, this company from this. But is that being adopted? And will we see insurance push that more to help stop?
I think that's the more pertinent question. I think the question of is it being adopted is probably yes. And Patrick and I are both on the vendor sides, and Jim, you to the extent as well. So are they adopting it? Yes, but at what rate? Because you can't go out there and buy every piece of every tech. So you pick and choose, right? Sam, Jack, you guys know what this is like. You go out and you're like, all right, what's the best? What gives me the best chance of having a shot to detect early, and maybe even prevent? Mm-hmm. And then, like, because there's a million options of everything. Yep. So, I don't know. I feel like that's a kind of a craps game. Like, you roll the dice and go, let's see what happens.
Yeah. I call it your results may vary. They really may vary, right? And I think technology is there. I mean, I think it's still evolving. Is it going to be perfect? Probably not.
I mean, I'm pretty dorky. So, like, I have a dorky answer to that, which is, like, I have worked at a company where the entropy algorithm that was written to detect ransomware is working at such a high rate that the answer to your question technically is yes. Okay. But then I got to sell it to a guy like Jack. Then Jack has to hand it to a team of people who I'm sure are super competent. Then they have to work it through change control and deploy it. And somebody's got to update it. So I think, yeah, there's been a lot of progress made, but I think, you know, in this industry, one thing we've learned is you got to learn how to use a limited number of tools really, really well. And that's hard. That's still hard. I don't know. Is anybody patched? I'm still not patched. I'll admit it. Like, you know, and we should have known how to do that by now, right?
Yeah, yeah, I mean, look, I tell you the joke I use internally, because I saw it twice in the last month and a half. I was talking to a friend, and he was like, "Hey, let me show you something really cool." And he's showing me a demo of this thing that they're selling, security organization, a vendor. And I'm like, "Hey, do you by any chance realize that you're giving me a demo of a security product? Meanwhile, your Google Chrome is glowing red. Like, please update me." And I cannot tell you how many times I have seen that. We're like, we are, you know, we're the best at security. Meanwhile, the browser's like, we haven't been updated in a week. There's a 0 day. Please, somebody do something.
That drives me nuts, Rat. When we're like on team calls, when you see that, it's like all security people and the person presenting has that glowing red, like needs an update. You're like, seriously? Like, this is being recorded right now. And I have to wonder, like, my fear that, like, you recorded that, your incident happens down the road, they come back and they see that and they're like, well, you guys don't even update your browsers and here's the recording showing it.
Well,
you know, I mean, I don't know.
I enabled my USB camera today. I just want to let everybody know. I'm apologize. I allowed it access to my browser.
Hey, so because we've got about 10 minutes and somebody was eventually going to ask this question on the YouTube stream, somebody says, will or can AI change the game? That's the expectation. That, Jim, that's exactly what I expected you to do, because I did the same thing in my head.
I just want to get like a big hammer and just paint AI on it. Just sit here and just do like this a little bit. Listen, there are great opportunities for AI. And I think this question is always going to be out there. I mean, potentially, but I think it may have an implication with regards to all the things that we're trying to get done, like patching and avoiding, you know, stopping people from clicking bad links and blah, 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 all the things that we know to do. Is there some way that maybe AI can help create a buffer to that sort of soft underbelly of the human emotion when clicking links, right? So maybe, but I don't think it's going to be like necessarily a solution that's going to solve the ransomware problem. I don't think that's going to plug right in. I think there's a lot of moving parts to that, but I don't know. But
Jack, what do you think? You've got the most unexcited look on your face I have ever seen you.
Jack hates this. Look at him. He hates this. Yeah.
It will be a game changer. I think it already has been. We just haven't seen it yet on the surface yet. But I think, you know, just the capability to the technology of many, many people for you in a very short amount of time, putting it very simply, I think that bad actors will capitalize on that. I think definitely it's going to be one of those instruments that we're going to be playing catch up.
I wanted to poke on the criminal aspect of it, right? So let's look at it from the standpoint of the amount of data that the criminals now have available to them in order to be able to craft better lures, right? Whether it's even just cleaning up some of the stupid grammatical stuff that's always one of the biggest red flags in any sort of phishing email that you might get. Think now about the ability for them to send more targeted emails to folks like myself and Jim and Jack and Patrick and James and Raph, and think about, you know, the profiles they can build about us online, so that they can send us something that is more targeted, more exact, and more relevant to us as individuals. So while there's certainly going to be a lot of advances on the tool side, I think there's a heck of a lot more opportunity for the criminals.
Patrick, I can't wait to hear your thoughts.
I think it's going to be asymmetric in advantage of the attacker, because the thing that people, in my opinion, tend to leave out of this conversation is latency, and the attacker has a latency advantage. It doesn't matter. The attack gets deployed, they attack. Like, we have to detect and respond in increasingly small amounts of time. So let's just say everybody's information becomes equivalent. The attacker still has the advantage on time. And so I think, unfortunately, I think the attacker winds up with the advantage. Until somebody solves speed of light, I think we got a problem.
And if I may, that is basic fundamental warfare doctrine. So it's called taking the initiative, and the weapon will always outpace the defense, right?
Yep.
Period. Right. So we can close that gap, but the problem is organizations are not prepared to move at that particular pace for cybersecurity. they're moving at pace at hyperspeed to enable the business, right? So we have to find a way to tie into that wave to be successful.
If you want a good kinetic comparison here, like, I don't think that it's an unusual comparison to say this is why hypersonic changed kinetic warfare. Mm-hmm. It shrunk time, mm-hmm. right? So when you're the attacker, you know, you want time to be small. And when you're the defender, you want as much time as you can have. I think it's asymmetric and advantaging the attacker right now.
Yeah. 100%. Sam was dead on.
Yeah. Well, that makes it super interesting because technology, and I look at it from this perspective, we are, as defenders, by the time technology gets, let's say AI, gets implemented in some way, right? Refined, we create a product out of it. We implement that product. Somebody buys it. They implement it. They test it. The attacker's been using it for a year and a half, and they don't care whether it works perfectly or not because they're trying it against 100,000, 100 million victims. And if it works half the time, great. If it works, you know, a hundredth of the time, they're making millions and they don't care. So that's where the asymmetry, I think, comes in, because they just don't care as much about the refinement of that tech as we have to. And we can't take down the business defending ourselves.
And it goes back to cost. You're not paying, unlike a hypersonic missile, it may cost millions. There's no assets that you need. No minerals you have to dig out of the ground. No forging of material. Yeah. You click a button and bits start flying around.
Yeah.
Low investment.
Yeah. All right. So let's wrap it on a point. I'm curious what you guys think. As you know, we're 3 months, barely 3 months into 2024. Ransomware is still a problem. It's not a problem. It's an epidemic. It's big. Extortion has been mixed into this. What's the future of this conversation a year from now? Anybody? Let's go around the horn.
I'd say, what's the conversation going to look like 20 years from now? And I think we're still going to be talking about this, unfortunately.
Okay. That's not 2 years. That's 20 years. All right.
That felt good, Jack. Thanks.
Fantastic. Okay. All right. Well, see ya.
No, but it's
called job security.
Right? There's law enforcement issue, right? There's the victim issue. There's the technology issue. There's the manufacturer's issue, right? What are manufacturers doing in this space to maybe build the protections to their product, you know, in the design phase and the ideation phase and build, put it into actual product that will act out of the box, it just won't be able to be compromised. That's one way.
Anybody else want to throw in? Sam, any predictions?
No, I like we're just talking about AI, right? I think AI is going to continue to change the game, not only for ransomware, but for other threats too. Ransomware has already been around for over 20 years, right? So I think Jack's spot on that we'll still be talking about it in 20 years. There's no reason to think that we won't still be talking about it in 20 years. Just the number and types of threats will continue to evolve. I think that, as I said, AI is going to play a big role in that as well as it continues to change the game in favor of the attackers as the cyber community continues to try to catch up with everything else that's happening around it. You know, every 5 years, right? We're solving problems that we've never tried to solve before. So I think AI is the current one that's coming up in this cycle. And we'll have, you know, by the time 20 years comes around, we'll have at least four other different problems that we've never thought of before that we're trying to solve for. So it's the game of cat and mouse that I think keeps us, at least from a security perspective, I think keeps us all interested because there's always something new to learn and always something new to chase. At least that's what keeps me interested because I love the opportunity to continue to learn. But you know, the pace is going to continue to increase in speed.
I think let me end us on this note because we're out of time and I don't know, wrap it on kind of where my head's at. Here's what I'm worried about in 20 years, right? Because I will be hopefully by then far away from doing this as a day job. But I imagine this, right? You're in your self-driving car or self-driving taxi driving from one place to another. And that is a computer that's driving you around that is connected to a network, which is probably on the internet, let's face it. And it has the exact same problems. Attack surface, opportunity, all that. as your laptop and corporate servers. What happens when that gets ransomed? How do we design systems, right, as we go into fully automated, like society becomes more automated, that when they are broken technologically from a ransomware perspective, for example, that they fail in a way that doesn't put me into a wall or into another car at 100 miles an hour? That's my concern, because that is a problem. Like, there's no negotiation at that point. You're driving along, a thing pops up on the screen and says, pay $50 or you're going off this bridge. I'm like, how fast can I reach for my wallet? Yeah. Right? So anyway, all right, guys, thank you so much for joining us. This has been an entertaining and fun hour. Jack, Jim, Sam, Patrick, and of course, James, thanks for joining me here, guys. Thank you so much. This episode goes live on Tuesday, and the video is going to stay up for anybody that wants to watch it. I want to – this is a great panel. I'd like to do this again. And Patrick, next time you're on, glow sticks.
Glow sticks.
All right, you guys, this has been great. Thanks for listening. Thanks for joining us live. Share this with your friends, and let's amplify this message. So for the Down to Security Rabbit Hole podcast, as we get to close to 600, we'll see you guys another time, another place on another Down to Security Rabbit Hole podcast. Cue that beautiful music, and we're out. Bye-bye.
This is Bella. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to leave my dad a review and share this with your friends. Bye.